So, Exodus chapter 2, and we'll be reading from verses 11 to the end of the chapter. Now it came to pass in those days when Moses was grown that he went out to his brethren and looked at their burdens, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and that way, and when he saw no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. And when he went out the second day, behold, two Hebrew men were fighting, and he said to the one who did the wrong, "Why are you striking your companion?" Then he said, "Who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you intend to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" So Moses feared and said, "Surely this thing is known." When Pharaoh heard of this matter, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water, and they filled the troughs to water their father's flock. Then the shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. When they came to Reuel, their father, he said, "How is it that you have come so soon today?" And they said, "An Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds, and he also drew enough water for us and watered the flock." So he said to his daughters, "And where is he? Why is it that you have left the man? Call him, that he may eat bread." Then Moses was content to live with the man, and he gave Zipporah, his daughter, to Moses, and she bore him a son. He called his name Gershom, for he said, "I have been a stranger in a foreign land." Now it happened in the process of time that the king of Egypt died. Then the children of Israel groaned because of the bondage, and they cried out, and their cry came up to God because of the bondage. So God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God looked upon the children of Israel, and God acknowledged them. Okay, so we're looking at a way out. We began this series last week looking at a way out, and there we were looking at how God provided a way out for a nation that was in slavery in Egypt. And the situation seemed impossible. It looked like there was no way out, but our God is the God who does the impossible. He found a way out. I suppose we all find ourselves in situations at times where it looks like there is no way out. Perhaps for you that is life itself. Life itself can seem impossible. But there's always a way out. And this series is meant to introduce you to the God who makes that way out possible for you. In the Bible, the word for a way out is the word Exodus. That's what the word Exodus means. So we're looking at how God found a way out for this nation of slaves. The deliverer that God would use to bring this about was a man named Moses. And we saw last week how God worked miraculously to preserve Moses' life even as a baby. Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, was destroying all the baby boys of this enslaved nation. Not content with simply making the nation slaves, he now wanted to cull their numbers by killing off all the baby boys. And at such a time, this baby, Moses, was born. But through God's miraculous working, not only was Moses' life preserved, but the king's daughter paid for his mother, for Moses' mother to look after him, until he was, we're not sure, maybe 9 or 10. And at that age, he was going to come to the palace and then he would live under the protection of the king. I mean, this is the same king, or the king's offspring anyway, that Moses would later on oppose. This is the same king whose armies Moses would defeat. But such is the power of God that this is the king who would nurture and protect Moses until Moses was ready to take the king on. So God's going to deliver his people, But to do so, he's going to use the deliverer. Mostly God does use people to accomplish his purposes. Only rarely does God work without using people. And in this case, the deliverer was going to be Moses. So the question is this: how did God prepare Moses for this task? Well, first of all, we know that God used his mother. Moses' mother was allowed to look after him. She was allowed to train him for the first maybe 9 or 10 years of his life. And we looked at that last week, where we read the maiden, that's Moses' sister, went and called the child's mother, and then the Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. So Moses' mother has Moses for certainly quite a number of years anyway. And during those years, she nursed him, she cared for him, she taught him who he really was, she taught him who God really is, she taught him how, as a created human being, he could relate to God, who is his creator. And eventually we read in verse 10 that the child grew and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter and he became her son. So from this time on, Moses lives in the palace. But even as a teenager living in the palace, he never forgot what his mother had taught him. He never forgot who he was. He never forgot who his people were. He never forgot who God was. And even right through his life, right up to age 40, he never forgot who he really was. He also would have learned from his mother about the promises that God had made to their forebear, Abraham, and how God had promised that one day their people would leave the bondage of Egypt to go back to take possession of the promised land. So Moses would have known of the promise given to Abraham back there in Genesis chapter 15, where God had told Abraham his descendants would be strangers in a land that was not theirs, and they would serve the people of that land, and also that they would be afflicted 400 years, that's what God had told Abraham, and also that then they would come out with great possession. Okay, 400 years, that's what God had said. Okay, 400 years, that's like some of the figures in the Bible, it's a round figure, could be a few more, a few less, but as a round figure it would be about 400 years. But when Moses was born, 350 years had passed. The descendants of Jacob had been in Egypt for 350 years, so by the time he is 40, that's 390 years, the 400 years, give or take a few, is almost up. So you can imagine Moses, you know, as a young boy, and he knows about the promise, and he knows what his mother's taught him, and he's already very excited, and he's thinking, any time now, God could be about to deliver my people. You can imagine him anticipating this and impatiently waiting for it and hoping that it would be in his lifetime and that he would see his people delivered out of Egypt. In the meantime, he's getting an education. He's getting the best education and training that was offered anywhere in the world at that time. We read in Acts chapter 7 and verse 22 that Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in words and deeds. Moses was learned, maybe a better translation there was, Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. So in the court of Pharaoh, Moses embarked upon this course of formal education, and this could have been at the University of Heliopolis, which was the foremost university in the world at that time, or it could have been just with private tutors, but tutors who would have taught him everything that would have been taught at the university. And that meant that he would have been learning reading, writing and arithmetic. Yep, kids, they learnt that in those days. Reading, writing and arithmetic, that was part of their education. It would also mean he would have learned about astronomy and chemistry and music and physical skills like archery and almost certainly military training. As a young Egyptian prince, he would also have studied things like law and administration. All these disciplines he's probably going to use sometime in the future, and Egypt is now providing him with free formal education. And furthermore, he gets a chance to put these things into practice. It says Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and he was mighty in word and deed. He was mighty, or literally, he was powerful. He not only did these things, he did them with great power. He was powerful when it came to words. At least when he was aged 20, 30, 40, he was powerful when he came to words. We know that later on when he's 80 and he's been in the backside of the desert for 40 years and God's telling him to go back to Egypt, he then complains to God, "Oh Lord, I'm not eloquent, but I'm slow of speech and slow of tongue." He probably said it fairly eloquently and fairly quickly, but that's what he said to God. But that's when he's 80. I mean, he's lived in the desert for 40 years and he's had no one to talk to but his wife and his sheep and his children. So he hasn't really had much by way of conversation. He's probably done a lot of listening. And also by then, by age 40, he's a lot more humble. But at 20, 30, 40, humility is probably not a shining virtue in Moses, and he was a lot more eloquent as well as a lot more confident in his speaking ability. The Bible says he was powerful in words. He would have made a good politician. He was also powerful in deeds. One historian tells us, this historian lived about 1,000 years later, but he says that, so we're not sure whether this is so or not, but at least it's recorded 2,000 years ago. One historian tells us that at one stage the Ethiopians invaded Egypt, and at first it looked as though they would conquer the Egyptians. But Moses was made commander of the Egyptian army, and subsequently he routed the Ethiopians, and then he took the war into Ethiopia, and he captured the capital city of Ethiopia, and then he came back to Egypt loaded with all this spoil of war. Okay, whether that was so or not, we do know that Moses was powerful in deeds, which certainly would have included, at least by the time he was 40, a lot of experience in battle. So now he's 40. Today at age 40, for those of you who have passed it, and for those of you who haven't got there yet, today at age 40, you usually reassess your life. I imagine they did in those days too. You sort of say, where is my life going? What have I accomplished? What decisions have I made in my life? Because you are the accumulation of all the decisions you've made in life. In the end, it's not even the biggies, but it's the hundreds of decisions that you make every day, day after day, that shape you and make you who you are. And of course, a lot of those decisions you make by the grace of God, and so to that extent, you are what you are by the grace of God. A lot of decisions people make apart from the grace of God, bad decisions. But the bottom line is that you are the accumulation of all the decisions you make in life. You are responsible for what you are. You are responsible for what you really are today. And that was true for Moses. I mean, you might think, well, no. Hang on, Moses had lots of opportunities that others didn't have. I mean, look at the privileged life he's led up to now. That's what made him what he was by the age of 40. That's wrong. All the opportunities you get and all the privileges you have, or for that matter, all the hard knocks and the bum raps you get in life, none of these make you what you are. It is the decisions you make in whatever circumstances you find yourself, whether with or without the grace of God, that make you what you are. All Moses' training and nurturing and privileges and life experiences did not make him become what he would become. It was all the decisions he made, many, though not all of them, by the grace of God, that made him what he was. Somewhere in his adult life, the Bible says, when he became of age, somewhere before or about 40, he made 3 critical decisions that shaped the whole of the rest of his life. These were not things that just happened to him. These were decisions that Moses deliberately and consciously made. And we read about them in Hebrews chapter 11. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. That's the first decision. He refused. He made a conscious choice to refuse to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Of course, he had great privileges as the son of the adopted son of Pharaoh's daughter. It's quite likely that he was even in line to the throne of Egypt. Okay, a bit of background. We're not sure who the Pharaoh was at the time, but the best contender for the Pharaoh at the time that we know of from what's happened in history was the famous Hatshepsut. That's a woman, by the way. She, in fact, later on became Pharaoh herself. She's only the second woman who became Pharaoh by that time. And either way, she would have been doing everything in her power to ensure the succession through having Moses as next in line to the throne. But if it was Hatshepsut, then at the time she also had a rival for the throne, which was her nephew, who was Thutmose. He later on became Thutmose III. And as long as Hatshepsut lived, she was firmly in control. But either way, whether it was her or not, it would have been huge for Moses formally to renounce the title as the adopted son of Pharaoh's daughter. And it would ensure that his rival, and no doubt his bitter enemy, probably Thutmose, but whoever it was, that he would succeed once Hatshepsut was dead, and then Moses would be at his mercy, and he would have to be watching his back the whole time. So this was a huge step to take. Presumably Moses would continue to live in the palace, but it would have meant a loss of many privileges. It would have meant that many of the luxuries and comforts he'd enjoyed for so long were taken from him. It would certainly have meant, whether the new Pharaoh was Thutmose or someone else, it would mean that that Pharaoh was now his enemy, who would continually see him as a rival and a threat. Now, maybe you're a Christian or maybe you're not. But know this, that to be a genuine Christian, you need to be prepared to give up some, maybe many, of the privileges you have enjoyed if you are to serve the Lord first and foremost in your life. Sometimes that means a cushy job. Sometimes it means a certain status that you've enjoyed among your friends and acceptance with friends. Sometimes it might even mean an inheritance or a promised reward. And you will be tempted to think, but why should I have to give this up for the Lord? What's in it for me? You know, 62 years ago, one of my earliest memories, five missionaries were seeking to take the gospel to those that dwelt in the depths of the Amazon jungle. And each day before they set out, they would sing that song that we just sang, "We trust in you, our shield and our defender." And then one day they were all slaughtered. But before he died, one of those missionaries said this. He said, "He is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. He is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose." You cannot keep the privileges and the possessions you have forever, but you will never lose by giving them up if called to do so in order to serve the Lord. The second decision Moses made was he chose rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. That's the second decision he chose. Well, there are actually two decisions there, aren't there? The first one is he chose to identify with God's people. He chose to identify with God's suffering people, even though it meant that he too would probably suffer in some way. If you choose to follow Christ, it is to identify with Christ, especially in the crisis environment in which we live today. But also, if you choose to follow Christ, it is important to identify with Christ's people. You are to identify with Christ's people. Usually that means in a local church. There's no such thing as a lone ranger type of Christian. It's important to identify with Christ's people where they suffer. If you hear of a genuine Christian who is genuinely suffering for his faith in your community, whether he's part of your local church or not, you are to identify with him. It's important that we identify with Christ's children who are suffering in other parts of the world. Like Moses, we choose to identify with and suffer with the affliction of the people of God. That is a conscious choice. The other side of that choice is that we choose not to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. And those two choices go hand in hand. You know, if you find a person who says he's a Christian, but he won't identify with fellow suffering Christians, especially in the context of a local church, you'll usually find someone who is very, very vulnerable when it comes to the passing pleasures of sin. He has such confidence in his own abilities and in his own righteousness that he will find it so much harder to resist temptation. Of course, sin is fun, at least in the short term. There is a certain exhilaration in, say, pornography. There is pleasure in making quick money, if you aren't going to be too honest. There's a sweet satisfaction in being able to lose your temper and lash your adversary with your tongue. There is a certain pleasure in these things. Sin is fun, or so it seems. But it is passing pleasure. The sweetness soon passes and you're left with a bitter taste in your mouth and a bad conscience to boot. You are the accumulation of all the good and bad decisions you've ever made in your life. But the one who refuses to identify with the people of God and who's used to luxury and who does not want to have to part with any of it in order to be part of the suffering people of God, that's the one who usually makes a lot more bad decisions and finds that sin is so much more fun, at least to start with. The third decision that Moses made was to esteem the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he looked to the reward. It's the third decision. He considered, he esteemed. So the word esteem means to consider. Now there's about half a dozen words for consider in the Bible, in the New Testament anyway. Sometimes the word translated consider means that you're focusing on your feelings. How do I feel about this? At the other end of the spectrum, you have a word for consider that means you don't follow your feelings. You weigh things up objectively as to what is factual, what is true. The word used for Moses esteeming or considering here is the second. It means that he based what he did solely upon objective facts, solely upon the truth. He didn't follow his feelings. He weighed up the facts and he chose. He looked at all the riches and the treasures that Egypt had to offer. And then he looked at the reproach of Christ that fell upon him. The reproach of Christ refers to the reproach that comes upon those who trust in Christ. If you put your trust in Christ, you will feel the reproach of the world. And so he weighed this up. He looked at all the treasures and the riches that Egypt had to offer. And then he looked at the reproach of Christ that fell upon him. And then he took into consideration that with that reproach, there went a reward in the life to come. He weighed all this up. And he said, there's no comparison. And he chose to put his trust in the God who would send Christ and bear his reproach for the sake of the reward in the life to come. Now, if you're not a Christian, could I ask you to really thoughtfully and deliberately weigh those things up? The riches you could have in this world and the reproach of Christ in this world and the riches of the age to come. Because if you do that honestly, I know that you will know and say quietly and confidently, as it is in Romans 8, I consider. I have weighed up everything, and this is what I've found, that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. So these were all deliberate decisions that Moses made, and they were all decisions, we're told, he took by faith. Faith looks at the long term. Moses was not into short-term gratification. He looked for the reward, the good decisions. Now, I can't leave this without pointing out a bad decision Moses made. At least it wasn't a good one. He made many good decisions, but he wasn't perfect. If you go back to Exodus chapter 2, let me just read that very quickly. Now, it came to pass in those days when Moses was grown that he went out to his brethren and looked at their burdens, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and that way, and when he saw no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. And when he went out the second day, behold, two Hebrew men were fighting, and he said to the one who did the wrong, "Why are you striking your companion?" Then he said, "Who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you intend to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" So Moses feared and said, "Surely this thing is known." When Pharaoh heard this matter, he sought to kill Moses, but Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian. Moses feared, Moses fled. And you think, well, hang on, if you go back to Hebrews 11, we read this, "By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible." So we know this is not talking about when Moses fled from Egypt when he was aged 40. This is talking about this jumping ahead 40 years to when he was 80 and he comes back, and he not only flees from Egypt or forsakes Egypt, but he takes with him all the Israelites. And that is when he didn't fear the wrath of the king. But that's to get ahead of ourselves, so we're not covering that tonight. Let's go back to Exodus chapter 2. And you think, well, what's going on here? I mean, it says he looked this way and he looked that way, and when he saw no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. Was that a good decision or a bad one? It seems good. He's defending the defenseless later on. He defends the shepherd girls over in Midian. So he's this macho defender of the weak and the helpless. But we know it didn't turn out too well. I think it didn't turn out too well because Moses is jumping the gun. If you go to Acts chapter 7, it says there, "Now when Moses was 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel, and seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended and avenged him who was oppressed and struck down the Egyptian, for he supposed that his brethren would have understood that God would deliver them by his hand, but they did not understand." Now, Moses hadn't gone forth that day to get involved in this altercation. He simply wanted to see how his people are doing. But he's 40. He's wondering what he's doing with his life. And here were his people oppressed by the Egyptians. They had been oppressed now for 390 years. God had prophesied, he had promised to Abraham that after that, they had been in Egypt for about 400 years, that he would deliver them. And here he was. He had all the training he needed, he thought. He had the best education of the day. He was a great orator. He'd proved himself in battle. He'd renounced his title and his claim to the throne. He'd shown that he wasn't interested in earthly glory. He had identified with his people and shown that he was dedicated to their welfare. And now suddenly, the moment has come. This was the opportunity he'd been waiting for. And he supposed that his brethren would have understood that God would deliver them by his hand. But they did not understand. What went wrong? I mean, it felt so right, it could not be wrong, as I think the song goes. I mean, surely Moses was the man. And he was dedicated. And he was conscientious. And he was willing to make sacrifices. And all his training had prepared him for this day, and the time was right. Even the prophecy given to Abraham supported this. So what went wrong? Okay, let me wrap this up by looking at, just very briefly, three common mistakes we can make in interpreting God's providence, especially when it comes to how we're going to serve him and what work he would have us to do. Mistake number one. Mistake number one is to believe that your formal training alone determines your work. Moses seemed to be ideally suited for a military solution to his people's woes, but that was not going to be God's way. Don't make the mistake of thinking your formal training determines the type of work the Lord calls you to do. Don't think, well, you know, I've all this training, theological training, whatever, and that means I've got to be doing this. The Lord uses all sorts of people, training all sorts of fields in his service, and you need to be flexible and be prepared to be used of the Lord wherever he will have you and whatever he will have you to do. Moses' formal training wasn't all wasted in the end, though he ended up doing nothing like what he'd been trained for. And your formal training won't be wasted in the end, but you might end up doing nothing like what you've been trained for. Mistake number two is to believe that you know when you are ready for the work that the Lord calls you to do. Moses believed he was ready, but he wasn't. At 40 years of age, he thought, surely now I'm ready. How much more ready can I be? But at 40 years of age, God said to him, no, you are not ready. I'm not sending you to this work. Man proposes, God disposes. It's easy to become impatient with what God is doing in our lives, but God's timing is not like ours. He has his own agenda, and it's up to God to decide when you are ready. And I can assure you, you will not be ready until God is. Third mistake is this: to believe that your training and experiences to date are enough. They may be. I'm not saying you are never ready, but it's a common mistake with all of us to overestimate our own abilities and to believe we are ready before we are. Moses was wonderfully prepared, his nurturing, his education, his practical experience, but it was not enough. He'd made lots of good choices in life. He was obviously dedicated. He was willing to make sacrifices, but it was not enough. He still had a lot to learn about God. He had a lot to learn about himself. He had a lot to learn about God's ways, and especially he had a lot to learn yet about humility. At 40 years of age, his training was only half finished. God had another 40 years of training for him before ever he would be ready to lead his people out of Egypt and to the promised land. And if he had succeeded in his terms of success, when he was age 40, the whole thing would have been a disaster. It was the next 40 years that he needed before ever God had finished preparing him. Amen.